This is my journey, inspired one story at a time. A library of leaders was created. It began as a journey to learn. As time went on, it began to grow. All it needed was a platform, and this podcast was created to listen, to inspire, to share. I am a storyteller, and this is my journey. Welcome to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. I'm your host, Steve Anderson, and today our guest is Gerald Leonard. He is a conservatory-trained professional bassist who offers a unique approach to accomplishing more in the workplace. He is the CEO of Principles of Execution, a certified minority business enterprise and consulting practice with over 20 years of experience working with federal and state governments and multinational corporations. Past and present clients include Verizon, Center of Medicaid and Medicare, Freddie Mac, Hewlett-Packard, Geico, and many more. He is the author of two books published. The first one is Culture is the Base, and his most recent book, Workplace Jazz. We just had a really great conversation today using his background as a jazz musician to help teams learn how to work together better and just kind of hit the groove, as they say in jazz. His ideas are supported by brain science and research. You know, music makes life better, and his analogies to jazz bands and businesses really, I think, hit the spot today. Yeah, I really enjoyed my discussion with Gerald, and I'm sure you will too. He just brings a wealth of knowledge, his experience, his analogies between music and business, and just a great conversationalist and a great storyteller. So let's just dive right in and see what we can learn from Gerald Leonard. Gerald, welcome to the program. Really great to have you today.
Steve, thanks so much for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Let's just start on about hearing about, you know, where you grew up and where you went to school and how a musician becomes a business and leadership coach.
Okay. So I grew up in Lakeland, Florida, Central Florida, between Tampa and Orlando, and started playing piano at first. It was okay, but I really didn't fall in love with it. But my sister had a guitar, and I'm not sure how she got it. It was Christmas or something like that. But she wouldn't play it, and I would sneak into her room and play it. And so finally one day she found me and decided to let me have it. You know, let me have the guitar, but also kind of let me have it for taking her guitar. And I just fell in love with playing. And from there, I joined a band with some friends, and one was an amazing guitar player. I became the bass player. And at that time, the Lakeland Civic Center was built, and all of the major bands that used to go to Tampa and Orlando, which is probably about, you know, 30, 40 miles away, and being a, you know, teenager, or a young teenager, not able to drive. So I was able to go to these concerts and hear all of the major bands that were coming out at the time, Earth, Wind, and Fire, you know, just all the different groups that are going on. And I ended up going to college and studying music and getting my bachelor's in music, getting my master's in music up in Ohio. And that's a whole nother little story, but just to kind of stick to where we're going, I then spent a year after I moved to New York through the Manhattan School of Music, studying with my teacher's teacher who from the Cincinnati Conservatory, studying with this guy, David Walter, who was at Juilliard. And I spent a year just professional studies with him, played in New York, and I did some ministry work, and then decided I really wanted to go back into music. But at this time, I had a wife and two kids. And so growing up, my dad was always there for me, so I made a decision that I would just play and work as a local musician. But then I got into IT at the time when if you could spell IT, you could get in.
Okay.
And that led me to combining the concepts of business and music, because I always played music. And then I started consulting and playing and doing things and started seeing the correlation between the two.
Yeah, that's amazing. And in your book, which is titled Workplace Jazz, you talk about the culture is the bass and your plan is the drums in an organization. So explain that further, and what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, my first book, so Workplace Jazz was my second book. My first book was called Culture is the Bass. And what I mean by culture is the base is, you know, when you hear a really good song, if you, as you're listening to this, if you hear a really good song, or think of one of your best songs, it usually starts with a bass player and a drummer. And the bass player sets the genre, the tone, the feel, the rhythm. Yeah, the drums are setting the rhythm, but you can take, you know, the same beat and make it a country song as well as an R&B song, depending on how it's how the drummer's playing it. But the, what really sets it apart is the bass. And once you hear that song, you know exactly the style of music you're listening to. If you, you feel it, you it makes you want to, you know, tap your feet or bebop on your head or just, you know, get into the groove. And culture is like the baseline, where when you walk into a company that has a great culture, you feel it, you experience it. And the drums kind of like lay out the business plan of where things are going and lays the foundation, but it's the bass that actually sets that cultural tone for the music. And so that's kind of what I meant by that part in the book, but also from experience. Again, think about your favorite song. It's always going to have a great bass line. And as soon as you hear that bass line, you know exactly who the artist is, what style of music it is, and what the song is.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. So you're still a bass player to this day, I presume.
I'm still a bass player to this day.
That's great. Now, you mentioned that you had a good story about going to school in Ohio, so I never miss an opportunity for a good story. So let's hear it.
Oh, well, you know, after I left high school, I moved to Illinois for the summer. And I was actually planning on going to Berklee College of Music. And but when I was going there, to be totally transparent, my grades as far as academics was not that great in high school because I was really, I was so focused in music. So I couldn't, I literally couldn't get into school for a degree. They gave me, they let me get into school for a certification. And I was at a music store in Illinois and a gentleman heard me playing and said, "Hey, you play, you know, young man, you play jazz." I said, "Yeah." And he was a jazz guitarist. He and I became friends, introduced him to my brother who I was living with, who was married and while I was in Illinois. And then he drove me through asking my brother and reaching out to the director at a college to Central State University where I auditioned, got a full scholarship, and basically went and did my bachelor's in music and then left from there and went to Cincinnati, where I ended up studying with Frank Proto, who was a composer and bassist for the Cincinnati Symphony. And what was interesting was that whole shift forced me to look at my life and go, do I want to go back to Florida or do I want to really move on with this music? And if I am, I'm going to have to embrace every part of my life and everything that I'm doing, especially with school and having a scholarship. So I changed my mindset about academics and, you know, did all of the courses. And in fact, my math teacher would ask me, why was I a music student? Because I was so good at math. And that's really because of being a musician that I became really, really good at mathematics. But that was a whole transition for me initially going to Boston, to Berklee College of Music, to ended up going to Central State University, where I actually did a bachelor's in music and then had the opportunity of meeting and going down to Cincinnati Conservatory and doing my master's.
Well, you found a way, it sounds like. You found a way. So exactly. So now you're a local musician, but you're in the IT world. So why or how did you then decide that you wanted to consult with businesses and become more of a consultant coach type?
Well, you know, what it was is being a musician, you're always playing different types of music. And that was the kind of bass player I was. I wasn't the bass player that was known for just one genre of music, like playing funk or just playing classical. I played it all. I played when I was in college and in grad school. I made a living as a musician. I played the Cincinnati Ballet, I played the Cincinnati Chamber Orchestra, I played the Springfield Symphony, but I also played in jazz bands or in shows. I would do concerts on. There was a couple of summers where I don't even remember the gentleman's name now, but he had a piano gig, but he needed a bass player and a drummer, and we would tour around the Midwest and play these concerts. And it was a paying gig that I played while I was in college. And so I've always played, you know, different types of music, being able to read music, being able to play by ear, being able to play funk and with my, you know, the popping sound with my thumb, as well as playing upright and classical. So it made me very versatile. So when I got into business, I realized that, you know, one, I had to figure out what was I really good at. And it became clear that I was really good at project management and organizing chaos. But also, I was really good at picking up new technologies. I learned how to code. I learned how to install and work in enterprise systems. So that background allowed me to become a consultant and then identify the areas that I wanted to focus on. And really, instead of going back and getting the master's in those areas, I just did the certifications and really took off. But at the same time, I was still playing. And it was a lot that I had learned from being a musician, because as a musician, when you first start playing, you pick up things on your own. But then to really get good, you have to go and get a teacher. And I was the youngest of six, so I had to get a job and I had to pay for my lessons as well as my bass, because my parents didn't have the funds, but they supported me in every other way, and it made it possible for me to be industrious and to do that. So when I got into business, I used the same concept. Hey, I need to find a really good coach or a really good program and study, find someone I can analyze and give me feedback and grow in this particular area. And so I was, again, doing both. I would play gigs and I was playing and I was doing consulting. And so I kind of grew up in my career doing both.
Yeah, that's amazing. You know, as I've said it before on this program many times, but one of my favorite business books is called Yes to the Mess. And it's written by a jazz pianist. And he makes a lot of the similar analogies that you do, that it is a lot like music. And it's like trying to, you know, get that chaos organized and then just accepting that things will never be perfect. You know, that you sometimes just have to go with it being messy, but you get through it and you lead the way you can. And music is a great analogy for that.
Exactly.
You know, as a professional musician, you describe in the book, when managing systems in an organization, you kind of use your knowledge and musical training and artistry, as you have just described. When performing musically, you are guided, you know, by your knowledge and systems theory and organizational behavior. So kind of help us see the similarities in both. So when you're performing musically on stage, and then when you're running a business, you're making the comparison that they're not too different.
Exactly. Well, you know, when you're performing, you know, one, you've had to master your instrument. So you're coming to the performance with a certain baseline knowledge of our expertise of your instrument. Now, the actual performance itself may be different. It could be, you know, you're doing something for a show, or you're doing a small jazz ensemble, or you're even doing some classical things. And you then have to take your expertise and target it towards the bigger picture, right? So you figure out who are all the players, you get to know them, you do the rehearsals, and then you start doing the performances, but you're focused on what's the big picture. Are you going to use every skill that you've learned throughout your career in that performance? Most likely not, but you're going to have the skills necessary to perform and play your part. But also the other part that's really important is to know the big picture, to work well and have a good chemistry with the other musicians. And then one of the most important things is to listen. To listen to you know, the band leader, or if you're the band leader, to listen to the other musicians, to get their input, get everyone involved, and then seek their feedback. As a bass player, many times you are in the role of supporting the other musicians as you're playing your part, and you want to make sure that you're playing not too loud, not too soft. You want to make them feel supported. And so if you take all of that and then you let's say, go to a business project, well, what do you have to do? If you're the project manager or you're a business analyst or a developer, you have to come to that project knowing your skills. You have to bring something to the table. You have to really be sharp at what you do. But once you get there, now it's time to get to know your team. Now it's time to understand the big picture of where you're going and where the project is going, what the business sponsor wants to accomplish. You want to be able to lead in a way where you're really listening to the other team members. If you're leading or if someone else is leading, you're listening and being really in tune with them. You also are open to feedback. You're also open to input. You want to know what other people are thinking, and you want to know what the sponsors are thinking. And also, when you're rolling out a business project, you want to think about your stakeholders as an audience. You have people in the audience who sit on the front row, and they're up close to you. But you have people who are in the audience who are in the back row. You may never see them face-to-face because of the size of the audience, but they're just as impacted by what you're doing. So you have to take into consideration the cultural changes and the impact of the audience that you're working with. And so for me, being in business or in on the stage playing music, they both have a lot of the same characteristics of knowing your stuff, being in tune with your team, listening, open to feedback, supporting, visualizing where you're going, having the big picture in mind, and really delivering a performance that's going to transform the audience, whether it's a musical performance or a business outcome.
And what I love about that, I think in a jazz band, a lot of times someone will solo, and then the other musicians will you know, kind of pull in tight and provide what they feel is needed to make the soloist sound even better and sound great. So I love the idea that you may not always be doing what you're best at or doing your best job. What you're doing is listening, as you said, and then finding a way to support the person who's soloing. So what can I do to help the team? And I think so many people miss that point, that they always think they have to do what they're best at. But sometimes what they need to do is just support the person who's soloing.
Exactly. By supporting the person that's soloing, you're really, you know, you're playing the chords, you're playing the changes, and you are playing the way the music is being structured, but you're really listening to the way they're interpreting the song. And you're providing as much support to them in that transition and in that support as possible.
And I think it wasn't Miles Davis who kind of had the reputation for, he was a huge name and a big star, but yet he really, really supported and gave opportunities for other people in the band to kind of show their stuff, and he would come in and support them in ways that they could shine as well.
Exactly. And that's the main part of the leader. In my book, Workplace Jazz, I have a 9-step framework. And one of the frameworks and steps in there is to surrender to support. And in I usually tell two stories, one that's a business story and one that's a musical story. And the musical story for that chapter is based on a bass player named David Dyson. And David's probably is about maybe late 30s, probably early 40s, I think. And he's one of the most in-demand bassists in the country right now, probably in the world. He plays with Gerald Albright, Peter White, Najeev, a number of other jazz musicians. But one thing about David, he's the band member and director for Pieces of a Dream, which is a jazz ensemble. And they were inducted into the Jazz Hall of Fame. Well, on this show, if you watch the video that I referenced on the link in the book, he's performing a song that he wrote. Everyone around him is soloing. Everyone else around him is getting the spotlight. But he's the director of the group. He wrote the song, but he never takes a solo. He simply is just sitting back playing the bass lines. And he just keeps everybody locked in and is just doing an amazing job. But his role was, in that song that he wrote, was to make everyone else look good and kind of lend itself to the bigger picture of the song more than him trying to step out and be the soloist and saying, hey, look at me.
And as in the business terms, that would be, he's just being a facilitator of the other musicians.
Exactly. He's being the leader. And really today, as a leader, you know, I really like Satya Nadella, who's the new CEO of Microsoft, because he's really transformed Microsoft. I think it's like now the second most financially capable, or that's not the right word.
I'm sound for, financially, yeah.
Sound financially, they're like the second largest, I think, under Apple, as far as the size of the company and what he's done with the team. And I was listening to a video of him, and he was talking about his role as the leader, and his leadership team is to model, coach, and care. And his focus was to model the example, to coach his team, to coach the other people in the company, and to really care about them personally. And then as if he makes a statement or says something that comes back and figures out that he's wrong, he openly apologizes in an email or a video to the entire company and just leads by setting an example. But the company's doing great because they have a great leader who's making them great.
Yes, he really has changed the culture in Microsoft from the early days, that's for sure. So let's talk about healthy cultures. When do you know it's a good one?
Well, I think it's one of those things where there's definitely tangible things that you can see, but I think it's like a good baseline. First off, you feel it in your gut. You know, if you're turn on the music, turn on one of your favorite songs, and it's like, what makes that a great song? All you know is you don't know the details of what they did to make it a great song, but what you do know is your gut says that's a really good song, and you feel it in your gut, you feel it throughout your body, and you're tapping your feet, and it's moving you. So one, there's an intuitive emotional part of it. Two, it starts with the vision of the company. You know, what's their goal? Is it just to make money, or is it to do some social good? Is it to make a difference? And you can tell, because again, if it's just to make money, then there's going to be things that'll be done just to make money, and it may not be for the betterment of the customers. But if it's really to serve a social good and to meet the customer's needs, then that's going to be felt emotionally in every interaction with the person at the cash register or a person that you talk to online, employees of the company. You're going to feel that. Next, there's going to be a consistent set of behaviors or values. And all values are behaviors that you live by. So if you are a person of integrity, then you're going to live with integrity, and you're going to treat your customers with integrity. And then you're going to see a lot of buy-in, and you're going to hear stories about what the company's done. So there's some very concrete things. And in fact, my first book talks about seven steps that make for a great culture. And I just named four of them, which is a great vision, having great values, getting team buy-in, and telling great stories that moves the head, heart, and the hands of the employees and the customers. So it really is a intuitive and emotional feel at first, but then there's logical things that can be done to make it a great culture.
And also like what you said in the book too, where you said that good cultures build brand ambassadors. I think that's a really great way to put it. You know, it's like when people are excited about something, they can't wait to tell their friends and family. And
right.
Yeah.
Exactly. In fact, you'll see them wearing the t-shirts and the hats, and they'll be wearing your brand because you've built a loyal customer, and they are marketing your brand without thinking about marketing your brand because they feel loyal to you.
You know,
and they tell everybody about it.
Yeah. You know, so many companies now have leadership training programs and they seem to work hard at doing that. Yet, you know, I wonder, why has leadership training not really kept up with the dynamics of a changing workforce that we're dealing with today?
Well, because, you know, the leaders of today, to be successful as a leader today, really requires you to treat all of your employees as like very talented artists or musicians. And so a lot of the leadership, if we're going back and looking at the basic, you know, micromanagement or leadership by walking around or you know, the OKR concept, we're going to have some objectives and key results, and those things are important. But it requires working. If you think about an orchestra conductor, let's use that example. He is not an expert in every instrument in the orchestra. He may be an instrumentalist and he knows the entire score, but he has the idea of the big picture and he understands the values that each musician needs to bring to the table. But when it comes to their individual skills, he knows that the cellists know their part, and he hired them because they know that instrument much better than he does, and they know how to get the sound out of it that he's looking for. So he then allows them to be themselves and bring them their best selves, and then include them in creating this masterpiece of a music. But then his job is to create the big picture and to guide them through the performance.
You know, a previous guest on this program, I think, described exactly what you're saying by saying that when you do choose to be the leader, you kind of give up being the expert.
You do. You really do, because you have to then rely on and if you're the smartest person in the room, then you have the wrong team.
Yeah.
If you're the leader and you're the smartest person in the room, you need to be a generalist that knows a lot about a lot, but you can go in some areas, you can go deeper, but you're not going to be able to go deep in every single area. So you have to hire experts and you have to hire people who have really put in the time and built that knowledge base. And then your goal is to get everyone to work together as a team.
Absolutely. Now, you've identified that creativity is the most essential trait in employees. And sometimes I wonder if most companies just kind of squash that attribute.
Well, you know, the good companies don't. Poor companies or mediocre companies do. And here's what I mean. Let's take even Toyota. Toyota is a great company. I love their cars. I drive one of their cars, of the Lexus brand. Now, why do I like that company? Because they have a model, they have a process that says if someone's on the floor and they see a defect, they can pull a cord and stop the entire assembly line to fix that defect. Now, that's giving employees a lot of power.
Absolutely.
Because if somebody pulls the cord for the wrong reason, you just lost maybe millions of productivity. But if they pull the cord for the right reasons and find the defect, then you just save the company millions. But it puts the onus down to at the worker level, at the line level, where people can be creative about, hey, what's the better process to run? What's a better way to do this? And creativity is not just, you know, visual arts or musical arts. It's how do you make a process run faster and smoother? How do you get the teams to do this better? How do you get group A and group B to work better together? And sometimes it's the employees who are closer to the work that use their creativity to identify what are the processes and parts and strategies that can work better than what the leadership can think of, because the leadership is so far removed many times from the actual day-to-day activity that they aren't able to come up with a better solution. And they really do need to rely on the creativity, the insight, and feedback of the line workers.
And related to that a little bit, you mentioned in the book that most people shy away from disagreement, you know, but then you make the point that disagreement is good as long as it is creative, as we just described, and also collaborative. So
it needs to be collaborative and creative and productive disagreement, because, you know, again, it's feedback. And again, if you're open to feedback, then that means someone's going to give you some advice and some input that you were not thinking about. And if everyone around you is agreeing with everything that you say, then you got the wrong team.
Yeah.
If the things that you're putting out and you ask for feedback and you're getting opposing views, then that's where you need to pull everybody together and go, hey, wait, you know, we got a great, here's my intent of where we want to go. Now, what's the best way to get there? If there's differences, get everybody in the room and have a conversation. It doesn't have to be in the same physical room. It can be get them on the same Zoom call, do an assessment, do a survey, but do something where you can get all of their input and analyze it and find the best ideas, because what you want is the best ideas that's going to move you forward more than it being just your idea. Because great leaders, when they're successful, they say it's the team did it. When they fail, they said it was my mistake.
Right. You know, it's interesting, you know, lack of engagement in the workforce can be traced to really two problems. And you've identified lack of understanding and lack of communication, which seems to be pretty pretty known. But how can businesses improve on this? So how do you consult businesses to get better at this?
So to get better at communication and to get better at just working together, it really is about everyone identifying the values that are going to get everyone to work together. So I'll give an example. I had a project team that we worked with this one team really well together. A few people left that particular team just because of, you know, moved to another company or retirement and so on and so forth. And there were new people added to the team. And I had a few of the core members of the team, but I had new people. And for whatever reason, some of the management of the teams that transferred in didn't give them all information. So there was a little miscommunication and so on. Things like that happened. Well, I did this exercise that I talk about in my book called Rules of Engagement. And I learned it from a lady named Judith Glaser, who wrote the book Conversational Intelligence. And I had studied with her for about a couple of years in a neuroscience certification. She unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago. But that exercise was one where I got everyone together and said, okay, here's some sticky notes. We're going to close our computers. And this time before COVID, where we were together physically, and we're in the room, and everyone has sticky notes. And I want you to write one word or a couple of words on each sticky note of what is are the values from the best groups or teams that you've ever been a part of. So everyone put their head down for 2 minutes and wrote out, let's say, three or four or five sticky note cards of values. Then we, one at a time, put them on the wall, and we built what was called an infinity diagram, which is basically a way to, if you had the same word, you put the sticky notes together. If that word was an outlier, you put it on the side. And what we found was that there was more that we had in common in relationship to what we wanted from a great team than not. Doing that exercise and asking people about what they experienced and also why did they choose the one word that's an outlier and why was that important to them, helped everyone to understand everyone else's perspective about building great teams and having a great team. From that day on, we had an amazing team. It was like we had been working together for years. And this was a team that initially didn't come together very smoothly because of all some of the misunderstandings, lack of knowledge, and so on and so forth. But that one exercise brought everyone together and allowed us to work really closely. And I think it was getting everyone united around the values of the group. And I think once you do that within a company and you then use that criteria to determine how we're going to hire, how we're going to promote, how we're going to work together based on those values, it really transforms the way the teams work.
Absolutely. And I think that leaders, you know, need to work hard, so to speak, at getting to know their employees. They need to know what they're good at, and they need to know what their concerns are, because that's really the first step to getting to that level of understanding.
Exactly.
You know, it's interesting. You know, I love the your analogy about the bass. And so let's say it's all about the bass and the drums. It reminds me of a Todd Snyder song where the lyric goes, be a singer if you want to be the star, but all the butts are moving to the bass guitar. I think that's perfect,
Exactly right.
Yeah, because I think
I wrote that book. Yeah. I wrote that book at the time that the song All About That Bass had come out.
All right.
It was around 2015 and 2016 when I released that first book.
Yeah, I think it's a great analogy because, again, you go back to when I asked you about culture, you said you just feel it. And you know, everybody knows when you're at the concert and you just hear great music and it's that bass and the drums coming in and you feel it. It goes right through you. In fact, and nothing's better than that bass drum, you know, striking and just going right through your heart. It just feels like it's an emotional thing as much as a listening thing.
Exactly. And again, think about your favorite companies. One of my favorite stores to shop at when it comes to clothes is I like Nordstrom Rack.
Right.
They're just a great company. And it's not just that, you know, it's a kind of exclusive or expensive store, but it's the way they treat their employees. It's the way they treat their customers. If you have a problem with something you purchase from there and you bring it back, there's no questions asked.
Right. And they give their employees that power or that decision-making ability to solve your problem.
Exactly. So they allow their employees to be creative and give them authority up to a certain level to solve a problem. And so the employees feel empowered.
Yeah, it's a great company. And it's another great Seattle company. So I'm from Seattle. So that's always good to hear the homegrown companies do well.
Excellent. Well, you got Starbucks too.
So. Yeah, we do. You know, it's fascinating to read the studies that you reference in the book about healthy children. And when they were given the brain scans and it showed that the more a child was trained on a musical instrument, it accelerated cortical organization and attention skill and anxiety management and emotional control. Yep. It's just, you know, what lessons or strategies should we take from this information?
Well, you know, I think what's really important is the value of, and I'll call it liberal arts, but it's the importance of music in early education. And I think, you know, when schools have a budgeting crisis, what is the first thing they say they want to do?
Yeah, music and sports
They want to start cutting music and sports. And, you know, kids need, they have all this extra energy. They need to run. They need to do the sports. But more than anything, they need to be involved in musical training. And here's why. It's besides all the scientific things I mentioned in there, there was an article that I read from a news feed that I follow on LinkedIn, and it's called Neuroscience. It was like Neuroscience News. And they had an article about, and this is all peer-reviewed stuff, so it's like really researched and peer-reviewed from other scientists, and so it's really good research. They had some kids who had autism, and it was between ages 13 and 16, and they had this behavioral issue because of the autism. They introduced them to playing the drums, and then gave them for 4 months. Two lessons a week for 45 minutes and let them practice at home. After the exercise or the experiment, most of them had actually changed their behavior from a lot of the outbursts and things that an autistic child would have. And then when they did an fMRI scan, they actually saw that parts of the structure of the brain had been changed to allow them to behave better. So even when it comes to, you know, issues and things that we can be born with, music has a way of healing. And I know for myself, switching careers from music to IT and having, you know, a professor or a teacher in college tell me I should have been a math major, that was because of music. Because I learned to read music. I learned to write music. I learned to play by ear. So musicians hear, you can tell the difference between a baby's cry, like a mother can, but you can hear the difference in a person's tone based on, is it, you know, you're a lot more sensitive to it because you've developed your ears. From really hours of listening to music, you become very sensitive to things, but you also develop neurological pathways that are related to math and logic.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And so, I mean, you believe, and you have research to back it up, I mean, you believe that music can change our brains.
Exactly. In fact, one of the things that I learned myself in researching and putting this book together was that something called whole brain integration. Now, whole brain integration happens when the left and the right hemisphere are able to work simultaneously. Most people say you're either right brain or left brain, right?
Right.
It's either logical or you're very creative. But what if you're both? What they found was that people who are musicians naturally become both. They develop both right brain and left brain. In other words, the middle of our brains is called the corpus callosum, and it's a bunch of fibers that connect both hemispheres together. They found that musicians have much more corpus callosal fibers that run through the brain. Albert Einstein was a musician. Henry Ford was a classical trained violinist. Winston Churchill, he wasn't a musician, but he was a prolific and Pulitzer Prize winning writer. He was involved in the arts. In other words, these are people who developed the discipline of practice and rehearsal and you know, all the things that go into playing an instrument or writing or developing that skill, and it gave them the ability to use their right brain and left brain simultaneously so that when they had to deal with industry-cutting processes like Henry Ford with the Model T or Winston Churchill with World War II, they're able to work in areas of uncertainty much easier than someone who was only right brain or left brain.
Yeah, that's really great information. I couldn't agree more. It's not one or the other, but when you can use both, I play the guitar, but I'm very much an amateur compared to a professional like you. But it's interesting to me how, if I want to learn a song, I hear it and then I start to play it. And to be honest, it's like digging a ditch at first. You know, it's very analytical and I'm trying to do this, trying to do that. And you keep going. And then all of a sudden it just happens. And it is like it shifts to that right brain side and you feel it. And it's almost like magic, you know? So I think that's kind of what you're talking about. Yeah,
exactly. And then you find yourself in flow, right? Where you're playing the song, you're not thinking about what chords you're playing, you know exactly where to go on the guitar. And as you do that, now you're thinking creatively about the song and things you can do with the song and different ways that you can interpret the song so that you've learned the mechanics of it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in your book, you make the statement, workplace jazz is developing the jazz mindset, an agile mindset, and then bringing to your work culture and creating teams of like-minded others in that same way. So how does this improve team performance by kind of developing that jazz mindset as an agile mindset?
Well, if you think about jazz music and musicians, you know, you have a chart and you have a song and, you know, you play the song and everybody's playing the charts and then different people in the band will solo. And the song is moving pretty quickly. And the person who's soloing, they may take the song and do something totally different than you've heard the other night with. So you have to then tune in. You have to lean forward, tune in, continually follow the structure of the song, but be more concerned about where is this guy going and how can I support him or her in their solo process and so on as you're playing the song. And this happens really quickly. Well, in business, a lot of work now is being done pretty much by what's called agile teams or smaller teams of workers. And they have to come together and they have to, you know, play the song, if you will. They have to do the project. They got a charter. They have meetings. They got a cadence. Maybe they're doing the agile development of a website or a business process. And they're meeting with the stakeholders. So they're constantly listening. They're looking for feedback. And it becomes a lot like playing jazz, where you get the structure of the cadence of the meetings and operations. But now, like when the saxophone player solos or the guitar player solos, everyone else in the band has to turn to them and listen and lean in. Well, in project work, when you're moving that quickly and it's now time for the business analyst to really lay down and secure the user stories or the requirements, everyone has to pay attention and listen and add in and ensure that did this person capture everything? Are we supporting them? Then when the developers get it, if that's where you're going, or the business analysts get it because you're redoing a process or a methodology, everyone again leans in and then lends a hand. So it becomes like playing jazz where you're constantly are engaged, you're constantly meeting, you're constantly having conversations, you're constantly tuned in, you're following the defined structure, but things are moving fast, and the only way you can do it is to be light on your feet, like a jazz musician or like an agilist. And so if you look at large businesses and you take the Apples and you take the Microsofts and take the Googles and you take the Nordstroms, what they've done is they've taken a large organization and broken into really small teams.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. It's such a, like I said earlier, a great analogy. At least to me, it really helps think through what you're trying to do with business teams when you compare it to, you know, making beautiful music or hitting the groove, you know, in a band.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, it seems like, again, just an anecdotal observation from my part, but it just seems like great musicians are more open to feedback and also being very comfortable with mentors and coaches and learning from each other and sitting down and saying, what do you know? What can I learn from you? And you know, share with us what happens when a business adapts a culture of that coaching and mentoring like that.
Well, I'll tell you, here's a great example. The CEO of, he's retired from being a CEO. I think he's a professor at Harvard now. His name is Hubert Jolly, and he wrote the book, The Heart of Business. He was the CEO and took over Best Buy when Best Buy was struggling. Best Buy, they thought Best Buy was going out of business. And he took over the business, and in the process, he himself enrolled a coach, Marshall Goldsmith, for himself. And when he was first brought given the idea of the coach, at first he was a little against it because he thought, well, you know, I'm not struggling. I'm just trying to figure out this new company. He goes, no, coaching is not for when you're struggling. Coaching is for when you want to get better. Even, you know, than you are. And if you think about it, I wrote an article for PM World 360 and some other magazines, and I called it The Richest People in the World Love Feedback. And if you think about all of the top, pretty much almost now, billionaire athletes, whether it's Tiger Woods, LeBron James, you name one of the top athletes in their field, they love feedback. And why? Because from the time that they picked up their, you know, club, picked up the ball, picked up the racket, picked up the bat, picked up the football, they've had a coach. And they know that the better you get, the better coach you got to go find. You got to find a coach that's going to make you a nanosecond faster. And they're not cheap. And so they've learned the value of paying for coaches, asking for feedback, wanting them to tell them, okay, what do I have to do to get faster? What do I have to do to get better? Okay, do I need to stop doing this? I need to eat this. I need to do this exercise. I need to go to bed by this time. I need to wake up at this time. I need to work out. I need to rest this time. I need to take an ice bath. They're looking for that edge. And what I found is that business folks at times can tend to think, well, I got my degree. I did my bachelor's. I did my master's. I may have a PhD. I'm good. I don't need coaching anymore. I've done my schooling. And that is the biggest mistake that anyone can make, because that's your degree, your schooling, that's just simply the foundation to get into the game.
And I think you do a great job in the book of just sharing a lot of real life stories of famous and very celebrated and accomplished musicians who are always striving to improve through learning from others and jamming with peers and seeking out the masters. And it's just kind of the culture in music and should be the culture of business as well.
Exactly. And in fact, you know, that's one of the things that attracted me to music was that, you know, spending time with some older gentlemen who were jazz musicians and seeing how young they were in their mindset. And they were young because they were constantly learning. They were constantly growing. They didn't look at life and go, okay, I'm in my 70s or 80s and it's all over. They were like, man, I can't wait to go back and practice this new concept I just learned from this other musician that I hadn't even thought about all the 50 years I've been playing. And they were so young in their mindset because they were constantly learning. And, you know, again, we can be that same way even in the business world if we're constantly learning and growing and don't just settle.
You know, when you talk about, you mentioned feedback earlier, and I read a quote recently from Oprah Winfrey, and she said that in all the, you know, 4 decades or whatever it is that I've been interviewing people, it doesn't matter if it's Barack Obama or Prince Harry or the most world leaders or the most accomplished person in business, whatever. At the end of the interview, they always ask the same question, and that question is, how did I do? They want to know. They want feedback. They it doesn't matter who they are. We all want to know that we're, you know, doing it in the right way, or we could improve on how we do it.
Exactly.
You know, you dedicate a whole chapter in the book to how emotionally connected teams build trust through this coaching. So, yes. What does this look like in the workplace? So how do we build that trust? Because I would agree, you have to trust your teammates to really hit the groove, as we compare to music. But in business, how do we build that trust?
Well, I'll go back to that example I gave earlier about the exercise for the rules of engagement. And in that exercise, it was defining what were going to be the values, but basing those values on what everyone already valued, and then finding common ground. And a lot of trust is first finding common ground. You know, even in our country right now, there's a lot of, you know, disconnect on certain areas, but there's so much more that we have in common, that we all have in common, that we all want for our families, our communities, and so on, that we have much more in common than we have in difference. And so how do you build trust? It's when you realize that you do have more in common. Same thing in marriage. What makes a marriage work is when the couple finds things that they do in common and continually grow in that. Things fall apart when there's that trust is not there, because there's not as much in common, or the values are changing. And the same thing with the business team. They have to continually grow in their trust by increasing the growth in the values, or redefining the values and ensuring that everyone is bought into those values. And that's why in my book, the first book, Culture is the Base, I talk about the vision, the values, and then the buy-in. Because if you have that, you got a big vision of where the company's going, everybody's bought into it, and then everyone's bought into the values, then they have to buy into you as the leader and the rest of the group. But you've already set the stage. If they are willing to accept the vision and they are willing to live by the values, you're 90% there. And then it's really the stories. And if you think about it, you know, what moves us more than anything else? What do we spend more money on? It's watching movies, right? And why do we watch so many movies now? Because we all love stories. It's like it replaced the sitting around the campfire.
Absolutely.
And you know, what do kids want at night? They want a bedtime story. They don't want bedtime facts. They want a bedtime
exactly,
story.
Exactly. Yeah, no, that's very well put. Well, yeah, and, well, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, well, Gerald, kind of at this point in the interview, I always ask my guests a common question. And that question is, in relation to leadership, what is a pearl of wisdom that you could leave us with today?
I would say be a lifelong learner, honestly, is just to continually keep learning, keep growing. Even if you are at the pinnacle, at the top of your career, you're the best of the best at what you do. No one else does it better than you. Then compete against yourself. Are you better today than you are yesterday? Are you better today than you were yesterday? And are you better tomorrow than you were today? Just continually keep that mindset of growing. And also then find a coach, someone who is, maybe they may not be in the same career, but they're at the pinnacle of their career and they're at a whole different level. They're 2 or 3 steps above you. You know, most times they've either written a book or they even have a program, or you can actually go and get coaching directly from them. I've worked with Jack Canfield. I've worked with Dr. Paul Shealy. I've worked with Dr. Bobby Stevens, Steve Harrison. all these guys are at the top of their field and continually growing. And by working with them, it's led me to other people around to build my own team. But it also gives me people to look up to and look at and go, okay, how can I implement this strategy that I've learned from Jack Canfield or this concept that I've learned from Dr. Paul Sheely on whole brain learning and building my company? As you do that, you're going to, again, you're going to get excited about life. You're going to get excited about your career. You're going to get excited about who you're becoming. And it's all about lifelong learning. It's what we do as musicians. It's what we do as great business people, great business consultants. And it just kind of makes life worth living.
I couldn't agree more. That's very well put. You know, in anticipation of this discussion that we're having today, is there anything that I didn't ask you that you wanted to make sure our listeners get to hear?
No, I think we honestly talked about everything that would be important to for everyone to consider.
Okay.
So I think you did an amazing job of coming up with the right questions.
Awesome. Okay, well, Gerald, this has been a complete pleasure. I love the analogy of music and business and how they correlate, and I think it helps us understand some of those more complex things that we see in business, but yet when we look at them from maybe a musical perspective, it makes a little more sense. So I appreciate that knowledge that you provided us, and you're easy to talk to, and it was a real pleasure having you on the program today.
Well, Steve, it was great, and thank you so much for having me, and you know, I'm really excited about the opportunity to share the concept that I've learned, and I'm continually trying to learn and go deeper in.
Okay, well, good luck in your business, and make sure you keep playing that music, because that's what it's all about.
There you go. Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. To listen to all my interviews, subscribe to Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and many other popular podcast platforms. Some of these interviews are on video, and you can search YouTube for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. You can also access the entire library of interviews on my website, orange.coaching.com, and that is orange.coaching.com, and go to the Media Center and click on Podcasts or Video Gallery. You can also enter the website from PILPodcast.com.